I'd like to call the legacy meeting to order, and we have a quorum, so I don't know if anybody's had an opportunity to peek at the minutes. Representative Erdahl, did you have an opportunity to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and they were some of the best minutes I've ever read, and I would move their approval.
Thank you. I'll relay that to my star staff. Thank you, Chair Erdahl. The minutes have been moved. Any questions to that? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. So welcome, everybody. We're kind of a fun day. We're going to start off here, I think, with many of us legislators, and, well, everybody in the state loves their animals. So we've asked the Minnesota Zoo to come today, and we'll have other zoos from around the state. I heard the other day in Capital Investment that we're lucky to be one of the, you know, to have all of our key zoos to be rated well and to be certified. What was that, AZA, or what was it? It was, I don't know the exact term, but Chair Murphy could probably remember. But today we have the Minnesota Zoo, and they've been getting legacy funds for the 10 years that we've been in existence, and they've got a great story to tell. And so with us today we have the zoo director, and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Frawley, and I'm president of the and director of the Minnesota Zoo. And thank you so much for having us today. It's going to be fun to share some of the programming work that we've accomplished. A little bit of a reminder about the Minnesota Zoo. Some facts that we're the fifth largest zoo in the country. We're lucky here in Minnesota to have one of the largest zoos in the country, over almost 500-acre zoo. The average zoo in the, size in, around the country is usually less than 65 acres, and we're a 500-acre zoo. So we're a large zoo, reaching over about 1.3 million Minnesotans every year. Huge programs with the schools. Over 100,000 school kids come to the Minnesota Zoo every year from over 1,000 Minnesota schools. The Minnesota Zoo has over 200,000 members, 43,000 households. So it's a large membership base for the zoo. And on the conservation side, we're home to over 70 threatened and endangered species, which is a pretty big number for zoos, both in the U.S. and across the world. So lucky to have a great zoo here in Minnesota. The zoo appreciates the support we've had from Legacy, from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And since 2011, we've been grateful to receive about $3.5 million per biennium. So that's been our, you know, amount we received. And today we're going to kind of go over how we've put that to work. So there's really four areas that we apply the legacy funds to. And today I brought some of the staff. The best way to show it is through, and hear it about it is through the staff. So I'm going to bring up some staff to help me walk through some of the legacy work that we've done. We're going to have our, you know, one of the areas, the first area is conservation education. And Nikki Mattson, one of our interpretive program developers, is going to come up and share a little bit of our conservation education work with you. The second area is access and outreach. And that's when we're going to end the program, Ms. Chairman, with some animals. We brought some animal friends, but that's always the fun part.
Fantastic.
With our Zoomobile. So that's our access and outreach. I'm also going to cover a little bit about how we put access as a priority this last 3 years at the zoo. We also are going to talk about our Zoomobile program, like I said, and share it with you. The fourth area is Minnesota farm heritage. And I think I'll just give you a little bit of a snapshot of the farm heritage work that we do. Our farm, if you haven't been to the Wells Fargo family farm, it's a large working farm at the Minnesota Zoo. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize we, you know, kids nowadays, sometimes they think, you know, eggs come from stores and milk comes from stores. So our farm kind of reinforces that where eggs come from, where milk comes from. It's a working farm. We milk cows daily. We have goats, pigs, chickens, ducks, everything you see on a historical family farm. It's you know, it also provides us an opportunity to talk about the future of farming, how agriculture is, you know, evolving here in Minnesota, the technology, the advances, and all of this is turning into better land use and better support for our ecosystems. So our family farm plays a big role here in Minnesota. The legacy funds that help support our farm specifically, one of the things we were able to do with legacy funds is expand the season for our farm. We found that Minnesotans really want to have more of this farm. It was closed for portions of the year. Previously, it was open from Memorial Day to Labor Day. With legacy funds and support, we're now able to open it March through November. We also have expanded our milking parlor and our milking demonstrations, which if you haven't been to the farm, you know, we actually do milking demonstrations similar to the state fair where kids and people get to see cows being milked throughout the day. And as one of my, as director of the zoo, it's one of my funnest things to do is watch kids who have never seen a cow being milked before see that operation, because it's, their faces just drop, and the moms and dads too. So we, you know, it's important people see how this all works, how our farms, you know, tie into our regular lives. And so it's been great to have that extra support to expand that that farm programming. On top of it, a lot of you maybe have heard of our farm babies, our spring farm babies. With that extended hours, we were able to open up for the month of April, and now we do farm babies at the Minnesota Zoo. We will average between 8,000 to 10,000 people per day through the month of April with our farm babies. And, you know, that's an incredible number. It's probably one of the most visited times of the year for us. Some of the highest impact days for us are connecting Minnesotans to what it looks like to walk and live on a family farm here in Minnesota. So,
Director, I'm just going to interrupt you just for a second. We have two questions here from, well, I don't know how many questions, but I'm just going to interrupt you for a second because they're former chairs. So Representative Erdahl has a question. I think he wants to take on somebody in a milking contest. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I did that once, and the other side cheated because it's volume that they measure, and he had dirty milk.
Dirty milk.
Mine was clean. Director Frawley, the question is these machine-milked or hand-milked cows?
Mr. Chair, committee members, machines. But we also do milking demonstrations with our goat herd, which are hand-milked. So, and actually, as a former zookeeper, when I was at the Minnesota Zoo, I used to do milking demonstrations with all the goat herds. So they get to see the machine operation with our dairy cows, and they get to see the hand, the old-fashioned milking with your hands with our goat herd.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director Frawley, so you've milked goats by hand?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, yes, I have.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
You know, I once had the idea that I live on a hobby farm, that having goats and goat milk would be a good idea. My experience was very poor. I found when you put the goat on the milk stand and you start to pull, the goat's legs all went like this. And it's hard to milk a goat lying down. It was a, we wound up putting a rope around it, having my nephews hold the leg, the front legs out, somebody hold the bucket, I milked, so it's like a five-person operation, and I got about 2 inches of dirty, hairy milk and gave the goat away. It's my goat story. Thank I've never told that in 16 years here.
Thank you, Representative Riddle. I'm glad you saved that for my committee. Thank you for that. Representative Murphy. Okay. Director Farley.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to do educational milking, you know, program for the committee members if they want to come out to the zoo and help them with their milking. So I'm glad to welcome that. Moving on from the farm, you know, another area that we said that the legacy is strongly supported is conservation education. It's our biggest category of legislation, legacy support. It allows us to expand areas like the bird show, our close encounters where people get to come up close and encounter animals as they walk through the zoo, as well as provide seasonal programming like our summer exhibit. This last summer we had kangaroos here in Minnesota with Kangaroo Crossing. Today, Nikki Mattson is here to talk with us about our conservation interpretation and that she's been able to create with the use of legacy funds. So we're going to bring Nikki on up.
Thank you, Director. Ms. Mattson, please state your name and for the record and go ahead when you're ready, please. Looks like one of the animals didn't make it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nikki Mattson. I'm the interpretive program developer at the Minnesota Zoo, and I was asked to speak about some of the programs and items that we've created over the last 10 years with our legacy funding, and the list is really long, so I will try to be quick with you today. But as Director Frawley had mentioned, we use our Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment funding to pay for a lot of our summer exhibits. And so as you can see up on the screen, we have our Kangaroo Crossing exhibit, and that was an exhibit that we did in the summer of 2017 and 2018. So my job at the zoo is very unique in that I do the signage that you see at the exhibits, but I do a lot of other things to make our exhibits really come to life besides for the animals that you see. So Kangaroo Crossing was a walkthrough exhibit. We hosted red kangaroos, bennets, wallabies, and emus in the exhibit, and it was an exhibit where our guests got to walk in and walk along a path in the exhibit while the animals roamed around them, and the animals got to choose where they went. And so this really immersive experience. And so one of the things that I do in my job is I try to make the exhibit feel like you're actually in Australia and sound like you're in Australia. So as you can see, we had signs. Another piece that we had is, or another piece that I work on is our theming and storylines for our exhibits. So our storyline for our exhibit was that we had a team of researchers from the Minnesota Zoo, and they were traveling to Australia to help native Australian wildlife. And their field research vehicle got stuck near a farm, and so you walk into the exhibit and there was this field research vehicle that was sort of stuck in the sand there, and kids could climb into this vehicle. They could turn the steering wheel, they could turn lights on and off. There was a CB radio that played audio where it sounded like you were calling back to your field station saying, hey, the Jeep is stuck, can you send the winch to pull us out? And then you'd push the button on there again, and they would say, well, it'll be a few hours. Why don't you go explore while you wait for the winch to get to you? And so that sort of set the stage for exploring Kangaroo Crossing and setting off through the exhibit. But this field research vehicle had crates in the back of it that looked like shipping crates that we would have research equipment in. There was a TV in the back of it that showed a video kind of highlighting some of the issues that some of the challenges with wildlife in Australia. We had things like a life-size crocodile silhouette in there, as well as a mock crocodile floating in the pond. And we had a lot of guests say, is that real? Should that be there? Did that get out? So those are the types of interpretation that we include in our exhibits. Interpretation is not, there's not only a science to it, but there's an art to it as well. And so things like sculptures and life-size replicas of maybe animals that we don't have or other things that we want to highlight about a location are included in interpretation, so in what I do as well to kind of really bring those exhibits to life. So other seasonal exhibits that have been, we've helped to fund through the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment are summer dinosaur exhibits in the past, butterfly exhibits, big bug exhibits. But we also do some, we also support some of our permanent exhibits. So things like Discovery Bay. And in Discovery Bay, again, there's signs, but there's also a lot of other little details and touchable features throughout. So things like sculptures of sea stars. So, of course, we wouldn't want our guests to pick up the real sea stars in the exhibit, but having a sculpture there that is touchable is a, it's a nice thing for our guests to be able to really feel the texture and see what it looks like up close. Also things like monitors where we have electronic monitors to help ID different kinds of coral in a tank or different fish or seahorses or eels in a tank. We also have things like interactive kiosks where we teach our guests about how their seafood choices affect life in the ocean. And so that's another example of an educational interpretive piece at an exhibit. And then as part of Discovery Bay, we also have our monk seal demonstrations. And so with our monk seal programs, we have video to support that shows where monk seals live in the wild or maybe how they feed in the wild, things that we wouldn't necessarily be able to show in a zoo setting without video. And so that's another piece of some of the interpretation and how we do conservation education. Conservation education also allows us to really tell the zoo's conservation story, and I know that my colleague, Dr. Stapleton, is going to be talking about some of the zoo's research as well, but for me, it allows us to tell the zoo's conservation story and then invite our guests to join us in acting on behalf of wildlife. So things like pointing out some of the rain gardens that we have at the zoo. Another area that we've done that is with our tiger lair, and so this was another project done with these funds, and we installed a donation kiosk where our guests can sort of take a tiger selfie and post it online, and those funds help us to conserve tigers in the wild. So I could go on and on. The list is really lengthy as far as the number of areas that legacy funding has touched as far as conservation education goes around the zoo. But thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen. Director Frawley?
Mr. Chair, just thank Nikki again for her work. It does an amazing job. We see millions of people at the zoo, and that interpretive graphic, all those interpretive programs are critical. I will say that it's kind of a secret, but last year we did Kangaroo Crossing, and what she's working on now is kind of exciting. There's an animal that's really trending that you see a lot about, llamas. Everywhere you go, I know I was at Target the other day, and there must have been four different things, like llama shirts and llama birthdays and llama everything. And a lot of people don't know a lot about that animal and about how they tie to camels in the same family. And so I think right now Nikki's working on a new summer exhibit at the Minnesota Zoo called Llama Trek. You're going to start hearing about it. We're going to bring in a huge herd of llamas where people are going to be able to groom them, feed them, walk them, and really learn about the relationship of the camelid family. And then we're going to be tying it to conservation of chinchillas, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So. Thank you, Director. Ms. Madsen?
I almost forgot. I brought some show and tell with me. So just an example of what some of our signage looks like. And then another thing that I brought is from our Medtronic Minnesota Trail area, we have on the wall, we have a swatch of a gray wolf pelt from the winter and a gray wolf pelt from the summer. And so it allows our guests to really feel how well these animals are adapted for our harsh Minnesota winters just by feeling the different fur. So I'm not sure. Pass them around. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Madsen. Those are great.
They do shed a little bit, so I'm going to warn you about that.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll be excited to see the llama exhibit. My granddaughter likes unicorns. I don't know how you doing on that one. But
we're working on that one. That one, a little bit tougher. But so the next area that we get a lot of support, and really important support, and I think it'll be interesting for you to hear about this. You know, the Minnesota Zoo is known for our conservation programs. It's been since we opened in 1978. For 40 years, the zoo's had conservation as a priority. A majority of our work is conservation right here in Minnesota. So we have Dr. Seth Stapleton, who's going to give us a little bit of an overview of our field conservation work here in Minnesota. So we're going to bring up Dr. Stapleton.
Welcome, Doctor. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Seth Stapleton, and I work with the conservation programs at the Minnesota Zoo, as Director Frawley mentioned. And thanks for the opportunity to be here to speak with you today. So before I get started, I just wanted to note that Legacy's played a really significant role in our ability to help ensure that wildlife, sort of these key components of our Minnesota natural heritage, are there for future generations to enjoy those at those healthy, sustainable levels. So So prairies are a significant part of our natural heritage, and historically were one of the dominant ecosystems across the state. Their declines have been well documented, and with those declines, we've seen corresponding declines in the wildlife that depend on those prairie ecosystems. The Minnesota Zoo began working with endangered prairie butterflies about 7 years ago. And legacy funding played a really critical role as startup funding for this program, specifically in the construction of this building that's shown in the image here. This is a conservation hoop house, and what we use this facility for is breeding and rearing endangered butterflies as well as the plants upon which they depend. And the program has grown by leaps and bounds over the past 7 years, and we've had the good fortune of being able to secure some additional outside funding, both from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as well as the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Today, we manage a relatively large insurance population of Dakota skippers. That's one of the federally listed species that we work on. And on an exciting note, during the summer of 2018, we finished our second year of reintroductions of this endangered butterfly to a prairie preserve in southwestern Minnesota. It's actually a nature conservancy property. Our work also extends to Poweshiek skipperlings. That's another federally listed endangered species. Once among the most common butterflies on the prairies in Minnesota, it's now believed to be completely gone from our prairies. So although we have been successful in identifying additional funding, legacy funding continues to fill an important role for our work, specifically supplemental, filling in gaps that we're not able to otherwise identify funding for. One of the big things that comes to mind for me is pollinator seed packets. These are packets that have some conservation messaging associated with them that we can distribute to the general public and really encourage people to take steps to conserve wildlife in their own backyards. And along those lines, this is one of my favorite conservation stories from the Minnesota Zoo over the past couple of years that I've been there. This is a picture of another endangered pollinator. This is the rusty patch bumblebee. And sort of the Twin Cities metro area in Madison, Wisconsin are the two strongholds remaining for this bumblebee. Several years ago, we used legacy funding to convert parking lot berms around some of our parking lots that at that time were relatively manicured landscape. We converted them into more pollinator-friendly habitat, and it's a great example of if you build it, they will come. So we were conducting some surveys this past summer in partnership with Dakota County Parks, and we observed a handful of these endangered bumblebees that are now residing on our site. So that's an exciting step, and it's a great message to be able to communicate to folks when we're encouraging them to take steps in their own backyard to conserve wildlife. Moose are one of the iconic Minnesota species when we think of wildlife, and their declines across the northern part of the state are well documented. With the support of legacy funds, we've been able to try to play our part in contributing to their conservation and expanding the base of scientific knowledge about moose. Specifically, we've been partnering with the DNR, the University of Minnesota, the National Park Service, and other organizations, working on investigating topics such as how wolf movements are related to moose movements and how they can impact moose ecology and overall moose health. We've also looked at brainworm, which is hypothesized to be a fairly significant contributor to the declines in moose populations, and how deer may serve as a vector for transmitting brainworm to moose. Over the past year or two, our focus has been on communicating those pieces to the scientific community, and we're looking forward over the next couple of years to expanding that. We're going to work with our partners to compile the complex scientific information that's been accumulated over the last decade. We're going to try to distill it into some more digestible facts and conservation messages that can be communicated to the general public, and then we'll be working with our partners to develop interpretation materials that can convey those conservation messages to the general public at the zoo. And, of course, here in Minnesota, we're the land of 10,000 lakes, and waters are really a core part of our natural heritage. And whether we're fishing, boating, swimming, or just out on the water enjoying summertime, clean water is a pretty important part of that experience. And freshwater native mussels are a pretty important part of maintaining healthy aquatic ecosystems. They keep our waters pollutant-free as best as possible. They filter the water. They provide important fish habitats if you're fishermen or fisherwomen. And they also provide a food source for a variety of wildlife species. So for the past several years, we've worked in partnership again with the DNR and the Fish and Wildlife Service. And our role in this project is really functioning as a middleman. So we receive small juvenile mussels from those two respective agencies, and we conduct what's called a head starting program. So we try to grow them as quickly as possible from that small size to a larger size when they can be released into the wild and really start to contribute to improving those habitats and contribute to improving that water quality. Legacy, again, has provided key startup funding for this project. Specifically, the example that comes to mind is it has allowed us to construct a dock on our primary water source that has really accelerated our ability to grow mussels and maximize their survival. Along those lines, we're also looking at how we can best rear mussels to maximize their growth and survival. For example, are there particular types of substrate? Do some mussels prefer sand that's not as deep or deeper, or do they prefer gravel or a rockier substrate? Do mussels like water that flows more quickly or more slowly? And the idea here, again, is to accelerate that growth process so that we can improve the conservation of mussels by returning them to the wild more quickly. And one of the most accessible forms of wildlife that we see out when we're on the Minnesota waterways are, of course, turtles. And Minnesota is lucky. We have 9 species of native turtles here in the state. In the picture here, you'll see a little device that's attached to the back of that turtle. That's a radio transmitter that operates on a VHF frequency. We also affix GPS transmitters to turtles. The idea there is to learn more about how they're using the landscape, what their habitat needs are, and then that can inform management practices for turtles. These transmitters historically have been purchased with legacy funds, so that's a really significant contribution from legacy towards improving the conservation of this component of our natural heritage. Another key piece of this work is the identification of nesting sites. So one of the key threats facing turtles at this point is predation by animals such as raccoons, skunks, and sort of those other small mammalian predators. Historically, they would predate nests, they would eat eggs, they would eat hatchlings. It wouldn't be that big of a problem. But given the development that's occurred across Minnesota, it's really increased the rates of predation. So we're trying to figure out ways to mitigate that threat as best as possible. And unfortunately, this is a far too common sight on Minnesota roadways in the spring and summer. Roadkill of turtles and a variety of other wildlife. So we have begun a partnership with the Minnesota Department of Transportation and once again the DNR, and we're looking at, number one, trying to quantify how extensive of a problem is this, and number two, are there ways that we can reduce the mortality of turtles on our roads? And finally, coming full circle back around again to the prairies, bison again are one of the big iconic species of western Minnesota and across the entire upper Midwest. Roaming the prairies in herds that once numbered in the millions and maintaining these important cultural linkages to Native American culture. So although we once had these vast herds that would roam across Minnesota's prairies, today relatively few bison are free of cattle genetics. So we're partnering with the DNR in cooperatively breeding and managing a captive herd for eventual reintroduction to state parks in Minnesota. And currently, there are bison in Minneopa State Park and Blue Mountain State Park. So that's all I have. Thank you again for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions if there is time.
Thank you, Doctor. Any questions for the doctor? I have one. Oh, Representative Green, go ahead.
You can go ahead.
Doctor, I was just going to ask you, are you in St. Croix, there's those mussels that are struggling there by the power plant. They're pretty rare and... are you involved with that at all? Or
I'm familiar with the project. I think the DNR is in the Fish and Wildlife Service are the primary leads on that work. And our role in that, again, would be to sort of function as middlemen if there is a need for reintroducing mussels to that site.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to take up a lot of time, so I'll just shoot out a few questions, and if you can't answer them, that's fine. On the moose is very something I've been concerned about for a long time, and some of the stuff that we've been hearing is that the old growth forests that never get cleaned out and there's no opportunity for new growth is also something that's troubling our moose population. The wolves take approximately half of the wolf population as it comes, and one of the questions I'll have is, are you working with the DNR on those aspects, trying to get these forests cleaned out, maybe even clear cut some of the old growth before they rot and die and get some new growth? The other one would be on the bison. Do we really have state parks big enough where we could allow these things to roam without any danger to the public? Because as you're probably aware, more than likely, that if you get a herd of buffalo and they decide to go, they can run for miles and take anything in their path.
Sure, and I will answer your second question first. The DNR selects the state parks that are targeted for reintroductions. And I haven't been to Blue Mountain State Park. I have been to Minneopa State Park, so I can speak to that. There is extensive management there. There is an extensive fencing network so that the animals are shifted around and that interaction with the public should not happen. So that's second question. To your first question, our role historically was more in the scientific research regarding moose and moose conservation. So our specific questions that we were addressing were related to those moose-wolf interactions, so potentially trying to get a better handle on the impacts of wolves on moose, as well as brainworm, which is that parasite that we believe can impact moose populations. I'm less familiar with your timber question, but one of the things we will be doing is bringing those partners together over the next year or so and trying to identify what we think are those key messages, what we think are the key issues that are facing moose, and trying to figure out how best to communicate those to the general public.
Representative Green. Good. Representative Bo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, Doctor. Did you say that you have bison that are genetically pure, and that's what you're working to expand, or?
Yes, yes. So our work, and the bison program is actually managed by our biological programs at the zoo in partnership with the DNR. But we are working to make sure that the bison in the herd are as free as possible of cattle genetics, and also that we are maintaining a population that has as diverse representation of the historical genetics as possible.
Thank you.
Representative Bo? Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Director?
Mr. Chair, we're extremely lucky to have Dr. Stapleton with us. I think previously he's an expert on sea turtles as well as polar bears, I believe. So he's got a wealth of information that he brings to the Minnesota Zoo and those programs. I will say on our conservation programs, too, they're world known. I'm fortunate enough to sit on the World Association of Zoos representing the United States, and worldwide, people know about our conservation programs at the Minnesota Zoo. It's got a great reputation, so we're lucky to have those programs. Finally, we want to talk about the support we receive for access and outreach, which is critical. We are a state zoo. We need to reach everybody in Minnesota, and some people can't come to the Minnesota Zoo. They have barriers that don't make it possible. So we're going to have we've brought in some animals today. You've maybe been hearing them behind me, but we're going to have our Zoomobile program do a little presentation for you and give you an idea of what it's like, when these guys go out throughout Minnesota to schools, hospitals, community centers, senior centers. They do over 650 hours of programming every single year out in greater Minnesota. We've reached, I think, up just about every county in the state. On average, in a given year, we can reach over 40 to 50 counties. But so it's a pretty expansive program, and it's in huge demand. But before we bring out the animals, because at that point I lose complete control of everything, there is one thing about access that I'd like to share with the committee. And, when I first became director of the Minnesota Zoo, a lot of people, we have a great zoo, Como Zoo in town, and a lot of people would come up and say, Como Zoo is free, and Minnesota Zoo is not. And Como Zoo is my first zoo as a zoo director, and I turned into a zoo director, so I got to give Como credit. I love Como Zoo. But we listened to that, and we looked at that, and we said, Minnesota Zoo can be free, too, because being free is about being free to the Minnesotans who need you to be free, so people that need access. So what we did at the Minnesota Zoo in the past, we'd do free Wednesdays, or we'd do programs, tickets to agencies, which is a little bit discriminative, because who can come on a Wednesday? So we changed our programs, and we said the state of Minnesota does a great job identifying families that need assistance, and there's a lot of great assistance programs in the state. So what we did is we aligned all of our access, our Free to Explore access program, to the assistance programs here in Minnesota. So now, if you qualify for SNAP or WIC or any assistance program in Minnesota, you now come to the Minnesota Zoo for free. Okay, and all you need to do is just show your card, show your ID, and you and your family walk in on any day we're open, on any time that we're open. Since doing this 3 years ago, the program has skyrocketed. This year, the Minnesota Zoo is on track to reach over to welcome over 100,000 Minnesotans for free, with no questions asked. The number one question we get at our switchboard at the Minnesota Zoo is, "It true I can bring my family?" So this is a program that's really made the zoo, taken away a lot of barriers. Our next step is to really get this message out that the Minnesota Zoo is a free zoo to Minnesotans who need it to be free. From there, we're moving on to two times poverty and people that are minimum wage jobs, and we're working with Corporate Minnesota to help underwrite days per every month so that if a family has a low income, that we have special days that allow them to come. For instance, Dakota Electric stepped up and funded a day and said, if you have a Dakota Electric bill, you now come to, you can come on this day for free. We had 9,000 people come on the Dakota Electric day. Wings Financial now has stepped in, and we're looking for other corporate companies to help underwrite these days so we can help Minnesotans that are in that income level get to the Minnesota Zoo for free. So access is really a priority of ours, and we're excited about that new program.
Director, thank you for that. I have a question from Representative Murphy.
I just wanted my questions before the animals came through.
Yep.
But could you talk a little bit about your service to the other zoos in the state, like Como and to Lake Superior Zoo?
Mr. Chair.
Director Fowley.
Committee members. We have a great relationship. With the first thing I did as a zoo director coming to Minnesota, I've been here 3 years now, is go meet with Duluth Zoo and go meet with Como Zoo and take a tour and walk the grounds and open up the doors between us. We have an association. It's called America's Zoo and an Aquarium Association, so we are part of an association. All three zoos are accredited, which Mr. Chairman pointed out. So that's a great standard that we all reach here in Minnesota, and we make that standard. But I think our doors are open beyond just what the association does for us. We've talked about sharing resources, sharing animal exchanges. We make sure that we have good messages when media call, that we support each other when there's media inquiries. And then we've also talked about getting together on crisis situations, when there's a tornado, when there's major storms or floods. So we're working on, because taking care of an animal in a taking care of a zoo in a crisis situation is different than other places. You have to have people that know how zoos work. So it's important that those doors are open. I think that I feel good that we can exchange and call each other for help and assistance. Our employees do it a lot at their own levels with animal management or animal health situations. And then we also obviously share that common AZA accreditation, which also keeps us together. There's a lot more we could do. I think there's a lot of new, the new director in Duluth, and just met with him. So I think there's a lot of more we can do on that front. But we do need to work together.
Representative Murphy?
I read in here that this is your 40th year, and that's a good thing. There's many stories we could tell, but you have 276 full-time staff. How does that relate to 30 years ago or 20 years ago or maybe 10 years ahead?
Mr. Chair?
Director Frawley.
Committee members. I don't know on top of my head, how that relates to when the zoo opened. I think that one thing when we talk about the staff at the Minnesota Zoo, how many staff work at the Minnesota Zoo, I think in the same breath I also point out that we have over 1,200 volunteers at the Minnesota Zoo, which is an important point to mention. Those 1,200 volunteers equal about 58 full-time jobs equivalents. So they really help, run the Minnesota Zoo. The zoo is similar to a hospital. A lot of people talk about our budgets and how we run a zoo. The zoo is open every single day of the year. I know as a former zookeeper, my days off were Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So everybody wants to be a zookeeper, but you have to realize these animals and the care and the facility has to be run. The other thing we point out is if there's two people in the zoo or if there's 10,000 people in the zoo, the care still has to be there. So we have to treat it almost like we refer to almost like a small city or a hospital running the zoo. The future of the zoo, I think we have some exciting ideas. We are 40 years old. If I was talking to a bonding committee, I think, people are getting to know that our future there is about revitalizing the 40-year-old zoo to your reference to the zoo. Your new zoo is now turning 40. The biggest threat facing any zoo is getting old, because, you know, deferred maintenance and asset preservation can pile up in the zoo because everybody's focusing on a new exhibit, something new. We've stepped back, and what we're interested in doing is working on asset preservation and working on fixing up the zoo for the next 40 years. So we've listened to a lot of legislators, a lot of leadership. People love the zoo. We just got to make sure we keep it new, we keep it a great zoo. So we're looking at refurbishing older exhibits and working on things that aren't so fun, the infrastructure, roads, you know, safety for the guests, safety for the animals, and making sure the zoo stays relevant.
Representative Murphy.
And just one more question, Mr. Chair. Okay. Out of the 500 acres or 400 and whatever it is, 75 acres, how many are used?
Mr. Chair.
Director Frawley.
Community members. We're just under a 500-acre zoo. Most of the zoo proper is about one-third of that. So about two-thirds of the zoo is a beautiful Minnesota ecosystem with lakes and wetlands and woods. And, you know, I think you'll be hearing from me and others in the months and years ahead that space that we have, that unused part of the zoo, is really being incorporated into a new strategic plan for the zoo. One of the biggest problems facing Minnesota and the world is technology revolution, which is good, but the average kid in our country is behind technology 10 hours a day and outside less than 1 hour a day. So we think the zoo can play a big role in connecting people to nature again and start using those 200 acres of unused woods and become a leader where we could be a gateway to the state park systems, a gateway to regional parks by bringing in hiking trails, cabins, tent sites, rope courses, and really growing into how they're moving into connecting people to the natural world, which is part of our mission, as well as connecting them to animals and saving wildlife. So we're excited about the size of our zoo. We think the zoo is a good investment because we have the space to make sure, you know, we can do these things right. And we're putting together a very exciting new strategic plan, which we'll be sharing with legislators in the months and years ahead.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Thank you, Director. Go ahead and continue as you're...
Sure. Mr. Chair, so at this point, you know, access, I talked a little bit about our access, but our outreach is best summarized by our Zoomobile program. And so today we have brought some animals with us. And Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I'd like to introduce Alex Tassa, who's one of our Zoomobile ambassadors, interpreters.
Okay.
And I'd like to let her take it from here and kind of give you a little feel for what a Zoomobile program would look like from the Minnesota Zoo.
Sounds great, Director. I think we have some staff and others from the Capitol. We also were joined by the representative, Katiza Watun, and I think she had to step out just briefly here, but she was here from your home there.
Right.
But if staff wants to join us up here, because I think you're going to be handing out or passing out animals or however you're doing it, but there's some great excitement in the building you've created. Before you get to her, you can kind of come and set up, but had opportunity to tour to Representative Green's point about the buffalo. Over in the Bellwind property in the East Metro, there were some buffalo, and apparently they can only keep them till they're about age two, because at age three they get absolutely crazy and virtually uncontainable. So that was their herd. And then I was surprised to hear about the turtle person just happened to be in Grand Cayman once and toured the turtle, sea turtles that they're doing there. And I've often thought how neat that would be in Minnesota to have an opportunity I don't know what you'd call it, but breed some of our turtles and put them back into the wild like they do in Grand Cayman. But I thought that would be a neat thing for Minnesota, and maybe we can talk about that later. But go ahead.
Well, Director. Mr. Chair, I think that those are great questions. If it's okay with you, Mr.
Yep.
Chair, I'm going to step out because I have another meeting. But I would welcome, I think, all the speakers that spoke, all the people that staff that spoke today, yep, could answer questions through the rest of the committee meeting. So if that's okay with you.
Yes, thank you, Director, for coming today. And I know you're available for questions if we have any, and your staff has certainly been open to that. And thank you for the work you're doing and telling the good story that's going on there at the zoo. And I know you've been good stewards. So have a good day, and thank you for coming. And hopefully we can get out there for an actual tour as well onto the property, and that's always priceless. Again, before you get, go ahead, sir. Thank you. Why don't you come forward and introduce yourself? But I still want to invite staff, bipartisanly, to come forward if they want to sit at the table, and you're certainly welcome. Please, we have lots of seats, and fill them up. Go ahead and begin your presentation. Sorry, I've held you off a couple times.
No, that's okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee representatives. My name is Alex Tassa, and I am a naturalist in the outreach department that we call the Zoomobile here. And so I did bring a few of our animals to show you kind of what it's like when we go out and travel the state and do educational programs. We're used to programming with maybe as small as a group as maybe like 5 or 6, up to, in the past, 300, not ideal, but large groups in all ages, all type of backgrounds, and working with interpreters that are signing along next to us when we're doing programs. So I'll start with one of my favorite animals that I get to take out on programs. You know, none of them are really my pets, but I do have one that I prefer to work with. And she's the one, if you've been watching any of us back here from the Minnesota Zoo,
oh, wow.
Laugh a little bit today, it's because she's been anxiously awaiting her turn to come out. So she's been making a lot of noise back there. Now, this is a 3-banded armadillo, and this is full grown, so I know she appears quite small, but this is a normal size for a 3-banded armadillo. And normally, what they'll do when they're resting is they'll roll up in a ball, and she's got little pockets in there, you know, and things get caught in those holes. And right now, that might be some chips, so if you do fall in a ball, I apologize, but we're not leaving any treats behind. It's just wood chips. So some will fall out there. And I just wanted to show you how she gets the name 3-banded armadillo. I'll be able to walk around with her, and you can get in with a selfie if you want. Unfortunately, my hand's probably going to be in there with it. But, you know, she'll start to open up, and you'll really get a chance to see her. But she's one of my favorite program animals. There's so much fun things to talk about. I will say I've traveled all over the state and done nights and hotels over the past 14 years that I've been there, and she's not one of my favorite animals to travel with like that. Because right when I'm ready to go to bed, she starts to wake up, and if you heard her before, she's digging. That's normal for them. So check out these claws as they come around. They are not sharp claws. They are just for digging. Not really for much for burrows, but to get to bugs. So coming nighttime, she is just like those little wind-up toys all over the place. And I'll show you. Oh, there we go. That's what I was talking about. I gave you a fair warning, right? But the 3 bands stretch across here on the back. And the cool thing about the 3-banded armadillo is that she's the only type of armadillo, the 3-bandeds, that will roll up in a ball. So when you look right now, she's pretty comfortable. She's waking up. But if she's, you know, sleeping.
That's so cute.
Good morning. This is morning for her. But if she's sleeping or something's coming after her, she'll just snap shut like a door. And this head and this tail put together, just like a puzzle. And what's special about it is here on her forehead and her tail, the pattern there is just like our thumbprint. So it's special to each armadillo. So one way you can identify them. She has lived at the zoo for quite a long time. There we go. One of the chips there. Just want to make sure we're getting any other treats left behind. But she came to us, actually, from the Tropics Trail. So if you go out there and you see armadillos out there on the Tropics Trail, we did a little swap this year. We wanted to breed one of our females, so to keep that population up in between zoos. So we loaned the Tropics staff our female 15-year-old.
very much. I don't know. Someone say something?
With you.
Oh. So I think we're probably just going to wrap up then. And thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your. It's neat to hear what you're doing, getting all those miles and getting all over the state.
I certainly do.
So we'll just take like a 3-minute break, a recess, and then public television can start coming up. But we'll just give like a, just as you're coming forward, Mr. Straczynski and others.
They can't talk this.
Hmm?
No.
So I think we're going to reconvene the meeting. Mr. Straczynski?
Commissioner.
Commissioner Straczynski, if you do you want to start? Boy, that was, you're going to, tough act to follow. I hope you brought something good. Thank you. Sorry we're a little late on your start, but...
Clever, Mr. Chairman.
And you have a great story to tell. I don't mean to tease you, and but that was fun. Thank you, Minnesota Zoo, very much. Mr. Straczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski with Libby Law Office, and I'm here today. I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television, and I've represented them for 37 years now at the Capitol, and it's an honor to be here. First of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and certainly the citizens of Minnesota for making funding available for the things that we're about to show you, what we've been able to accomplish in the past year. Public television reaches into every home in Minnesota, reaches every citizen. I think our public affairs programming is well known, and I think we fashion better citizens and high-quality citizens as a result of all of that. Our cradle-to-grave educational services are very superior, and our services involve and inspire, certainly. It's interesting. Public television is not a school, but it provides education. We're not a social service agency, but yet we do improve lives of people. We're not a symphony, a theater, or a museum, but we chronicle region's arts history. And certainly we bring that arts and culture into every home in Minnesota in a variety of ways. So I'm pleased to have with me today Bill Sanford, who is the president of Bemidji Public Television Station, but also the president of the Minnesota Public Television Association, and speaks to you on behalf of all six of the station managers. And also we have Ashley Rowe from Twin Cities Public Television. We'll be speaking a little bit later, talking about things we've done in Legacy over the years. And certainly Katie Carpenter, whom you all perhaps have met before. She was the project director for the Minnesota Remembers Vietnam Project. And I want to thank you in particular for funding that program last year. You hear a lot about it, but as a 50-year returned veteran from Vietnam, 50 years ago, I was there in 1968, I certainly appreciate what you did and what you did on behalf of all veterans in Minnesota and all of our families. and war protesters and anybody who was involved in that period in our lives was so significant. But I personally want to thank you for your support of that particular initiative.
Thank you for your service, sir. And I know former Chair Gunther is disappointed he can't be here today, but he very much believed in you, and as did many of the members in that project. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to turn over to Bill Sanford at this time.
Mr. Sanford.
Thank you, Chair Lilly, members of the committee. My name is Bill Sanford, and I manage Lakeland PBS, serving north-central Minnesota with stations in both Bemidji and Brainerd. In addition, this year I'm serving as the chair of the Minnesota Public Television Association. First and foremost, I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today, and thank you for the state's investment of legacy funding for public television programming since the inception of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we have a compelling story to both show you and tell about how Minnesota is rich with arts, culture, and history, and we've made it accessible not only to all Minnesotans, but through our web-based distribution to basically anyone, anywhere. I think you'll see that we've been good stewards of these funds. I know that you have several new legislators on the committee, so before my colleagues get into the details of our public service made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, I'd like to take a few minutes and talk about how public television is really unique here in the state of Minnesota. Also discuss the strong partnership that we've had with the state for almost 50 years, providing quality programming and services and great value for the state's investment. In several of our bordering states, public television is owned and operated by the states as state agencies. All the employees are state employees, and the states are fiscally responsible for the entire operation of public television in those states. In Minnesota, it's really different. There are six separate entities that are individual 501c3 nonprofits, and they're community-based organizations that manage and operate Minnesota's public television stations. WDSE-TV serves Duluth and Hibbing and northeastern Minnesota. Lakeland PBS, our station, Bemidji and Brainerd serves north-central Minnesota. Prairie Public, Moorhead and Crookston serves northwestern Minnesota. Pioneer Public Television, Granite Falls and Fergus Falls serves southwest Minnesota. KSMQ-TV, Austin and Rochester serves southeastern Minnesota. And Twin Cities PBS, Minneapolis-St. Paul, serves the metro area and south central Minnesota. While each of these organizations is independently managed and governed, all are members of the Minnesota Public Television Association, and we work cooperatively through the MPTA. Each organization is owned by the communities it serves and it has its own local volunteer board of directors from within its service area. Because of this local governance and control, the entire state benefits with relevant local programming that is focused on each organization's service area throughout the state. In addition, this structure of independently owned and operated public television stations across Minnesota provides better value to the taxpayers. The state's investment is leveraged with federal matching dollars from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and each station across the state works hard to raise funds locally from foundations, businesses, and individuals. Unlike state-owned and operated public television in bordering states, the state of Minnesota's investment is significantly smaller per taxpayer and yet provides a public television system that is second to none in the nation, providing more truly local programming and services for the citizens of Minnesota. Another benefit for the citizens of Minnesota is that there's no financial barriers when it comes to watching public television. It's broadcast across the state free over the air, allowing everyone to watch, whether they're able to purchase expensive cable or satellite television or not. I'll close my remarks once again in saying thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today, and thank you for your investment and partnership in public television. It's now my pleasure to introduce Ashley Rowe, who serves as the Managing Director for Arts and Culture at TPT. And Ashley will go into some detail about the impactful programming that the MPTA stations have produced to showcase Minnesota's rich and vibrant arts, culture, and history. And now I'll throw it over to Ashley.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. Members and staff, I just I got a little carried away with the animals, so we might just go a few minutes past 15, and if you do have to go, I'd certainly understand, but I think some of us are, I'm hoping, are able to stay, and please tell your story because it's a great one. And Ms. Rowe.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Lilly, Vice Chair Waslewick, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Ashley Rowe, and I've been with Twin Cities PBS and our arts and cultural series Minnesota Original since 2009 when the MPTA first received legacy funding. It is a privilege to be here and an honor to represent the state in all that we create and distribute because of legacy. In the last 10 years, in hundreds of programs, the MPTA has featured more than 15,000 Minnesota artists, historians, and experts, and partner with 7,000 others. We have produced 1,000 hours of content, available all for free, as Bill said, streaming online, and we have broadcast nearly 16,000 hours of legacy-funded content in our region. Public television amplifies the work happening here and now, and fuels new work contributing to our growing arts economy and communities. Public television has the power of national distribution as well. Many of our legacy-funded programs are available to 66 million households on PBS stations in 40 states, resulting in more business for our local artists and more Americans learning about our arts, culture, and history here in Minnesota. We evolve with the needs of our local audiences by making our content available in more places and creating more ways for our communities to engage. The MPTA works together to share best practices and collect data and stories of impact. One Northern Minnesota viewer said that our legacy programming is, quote, essential to life in Minnesota, reflecting the beauty, creativity, depth, and passion of our core cultural values. Minnesotans see how they connect to our communities and how they connect to each other through our programming. Here are some of the many examples. After one of our events uplifting emerging artists of color, we heard, here are different groups coming together, starting to understand each other. This makes us stronger together. A St. Paul Public Schools high school teacher says that her students engage more in school because they see themselves and their neighborhoods reflected in our content, which has been integrated into their curriculum. Our nearly 1,000 online educational resources and ongoing workshops are valuable for teachers. One Fergus Falls educator said, Prairie Public Television's education services provide high-quality engaging experiences for teachers who don't have a lot of opportunities for professional development. WDSE's Making It Up North series sparked the launch of a new nonprofit hosting cultural exchanges and community development events at the historic Oldenburg House in Carlton. A visually impaired southeastern Minnesotan told us he is able to enjoy concerts because KSMQ's productions and broadcasts. More than 200 episodes of Lakeland PBS's Common Ground series have resulted in invaluable cultural understanding and in unprecedented visibility and sales for working artists throughout northern Minnesota. Pioneer Public Television's local history story about the Fagin Fighters World War II Museum led to a private donation for a new 18,000-square-foot facility in Granite Falls to build new partnerships, host community meetings, and tell even more stories about their region. In the 10 years that I've been working with Legacy, one of the most moving stories for me that continues to evolve is about the Giving Voice Chorus. For those living with Alzheimer's and their care partners, the Alzheimer's Chorus, that may be the first of its kind in the nation, was first funded by a state arts board grant. In 2014, McPhail opened its doors to give the chorus a home. The singers had a place now where they felt dignified, they could make new memories, and even go on what seemed like a first date. We created a video about the remarkable Alzheimer's Chorus that was shared online by National PBS, inundating its founders with online conversations, calls, emails from people all over the globe asking how could they start a community chorus like that. The Giving Voice Chorus embedded our content on their website and created a toolkit. And to date, the Giving Voice Chorus has inspired 30 new choruses in the U.S. and Canada, 28 in the U.K. and Ireland, and 6 in Australia. We place a high value on the arts because the arts impact all of us. And our Minnesota stories make an impact here and around the world. But the recognition belongs to those whose stories we tell and to our audiences who meet someone new, engage in the arts, and have a greater sense of understanding because of the stories we've shared. Legacy and public television make it possible and I believe are powerful together. The MPTA's goals include developing new partnerships to strengthen our communities, providing creative and relevant resources for students and educators, and continuing to leverage legacy dollars to attract additional funding to create even more meaningful and programs and projects. Next, we will play a 5-minute video about our work, if there's time, directly followed by a clip about our statewide initiative, Minnesota Remembers Vietnam, and then you'll hear from our Vietnam Special Project Lead, Katie Carpenter.
Thank you very much. Go ahead and...
Enough time. Okay. Legacy funding empowers the 6 PBS stations of the Minnesota Public Television Association to create content that inspires and that is accessible to millions across Minnesota and across the globe. On air, online, in classrooms, and in our communities. Since 2009, legacy funding has fueled our producers to get out in Minnesota and create more than 1,000 hours of legacy-funded programming. And our stations have broadcast more than 16,000 hours of legacy-funded work. Over the past 2 years, this funding has supported over 32 full-time positions, essential to bringing fresh and important ideas to life. Like Minnesota Experience, TPT's new history initiative that brings Minnesota past into focus today. Anchored by weekly broadcasts of new history documentaries and classics from statewide archives, Minnesota Experience offers context, connection, and common ground. Through local partnerships and collaborations inspired by legacy, public television has deepened connections with our communities and with audiences throughout Minnesota. Pioneer Public Television partnered with Upper Sioux community elder Walter Super Labatt to share his stories of Dakota art and history.
Owangwashde, Wokaka. That word for art is kind of like making beauty. Isn't that a good description of art?
The production strengthened cultural bonds and inspired more responsible storytelling that builds deeper understanding. Broadcasts of our programs give voice to Minnesota stories that matter and amplify them to more than 5 million regional households. And legacy-funded content has garnered over 26 million online views since 2009. Programs like KSMQ's Let's Go Minnesota showcase and celebrate Minnesota's beauty and where and how to get out and enjoy it. Making It Up North from WDSE taps into the creative entrepreneurship inspiring northern Minnesota makers who are taking risks and emboldening the next generation to learn the craft and start small businesses of their own. Artists report they are selling more work as a result, and viewers tell us they are spending more on the arts, attending more arts events, and contributing more to their local economies because of our programs. In its 9th season, Prairie Public Broadcasting's Prairie Mosaics celebrates Northwest Minnesota's history, arts, and culture. And Prairie Musicians introduces new sounds to viewers across the state and worldwide. Millions beyond Minnesota are discovering local artists and learning about our diverse communities through visibility from national distribution on PBS. Minnesota Original, TPT's signature arts and cultural series, is airing on public television stations in 40 states and is available to more than 66 million U.S. households.
We actually need to collaborate for our communities to be saturated and supported through art.
Lakeland's collaboration with Native artists preserves culture and language for future generations.
You have to understand where you come from in order to know where you're going.
Free access to more than 900 educational guides, as well as access to all of our programs online, empowers educators to bring more local voices and Minnesota history into the classroom.
Kids are way more sophisticated than we give them credit for. It's so important to reveal the identities and who we are in this community. I think it's like a doorway into further education.
The newly relaunched PBS Learning Media site expands this impact even further, by offering educators free access to thousands of resources needed to fully utilize digital learning. This powerful online tool is accessed by tens of thousands of Minnesota educators, with more than 1 million unique users each month during the school year. Our communities tell us that our work is essential to their learning, their sense of community, and their appreciation of this place we call home. The MPTA looks forward to our next chapter together in telling Minnesota's untold stories, stories that inspire, educate, and connect us. Many stories, one state, our legacy.
Over the past year, we have undertaken what has been the largest and one of the most important projects in the station's 60-year history. Minnesota remembers Vietnam.
It was exciting because we had an opportunity to tell our stories. We have never been asked to tell our story. It was healing for us.
I just never thought that I would have an opportunity to present my war. It's a big honor and a responsibility.
A lot of veterans just want to be heard. That's where the healing is.
You really asked us to tell our story, and we told our story our way.
The community's experience felt honored, that their individual stories felt heard and remembered and validated.
When you see a person wearing that Vietnam ball cap, know that for the past 50 years they've been living their best life, and there's an awful lot that they should be proud of.
The people who I went through it with are now my best friends.
With our colleagues across Minnesota, Twin Cities PBS is honored to have played a small role in helping us all remember, honor, and understand.
Ms. Carpenter, thank you. I'm sorry we're so down to like few minutes, but thank you very much. It's powerful pieces, all of that. But go ahead.
Thanks. Okay, I'll try to keep it very quick.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Chair Lilly, Vice Chair Wazlowick, members of the committee. My name is Katie Carpenter. I'm with Twin Cities PBS, and I'm the project lead of Minnesota Remembers Vietnam. And I'm grateful to be here today just to thank you for your leadership and support of this effort, because I have witnessed firsthand how this initiative has sparked hope and healing in our community. As both Bill and Ashley talked about in their testimonies, they mentioned that public media prioritizes community partnerships to build trust that results in authentic storytelling, meaningful opportunities to connect, and new ways to educate and engage younger generations. And this initiative really is a prime example of that kind of partnership. And I'm honored to share a couple examples today. It was here a couple years ago that we received $650,000 in legacy funding. And this really was a foundation of confidence that sparked a tremendous outpouring of community support. In all, we raised $2 million to support this initiative, and we launched for the MPTA what was the most ambitious collaborative statewide initiative in our station's history. Minnesota Remembers Vietnam features an online story wall, original documentaries, a series of public events, all designed to help Minnesotans remember, honor, and understand the Vietnam War and also its lasting impact today. We conceived of this initiative about 2 years ago when we found out that Ken Burns and Lynn Novick were presenting their definitive 18-hour-long documentary series called The Vietnam War. We wanted to do something to bring this story a little bit closer to home. So the MPTA created 17 powerful documentaries and programs released in conjunction with that series. We told stories about the Hmong Special Guerrilla Unit veterans who fought with the U.S. in the secret war in Laos. We talked to Native American Vietnam veterans, Gold Star families, and also those who fought against the war at home. And over 2 million tuned in to our broadcasts, and over 2.5 million viewed online. And a lot of our programs, several of our documentaries, reached beyond Minnesota, reaching 80% of U.S. households, including the secret war documentary. So we, a key part of this was really to make it inclusive and accessible. So we designed what we called the Story Wall, which now houses 1,000 personal stories shared all across Minnesota about how they viewed the war and their personal experiences. Really, I encourage you to check out this website. You'll find, journal entries, artwork sketched in Vietnam. You can hear music and audio letters that people recorded overseas. And it really, the process for those who shared, they said, was very healing for them. Many had never shared their story before, and this was the first time for them to really be heard and also connect with each other online. One person wrote, "Just writing my story for the Story Wall keeps the ghosts away." And another said, "The fact that people now want to hear of my experiences makes me feel significant." So how did we get 1,000 stories? The MPTA traveled the state to collect stories and artifacts. We went to class reunions, veteran organizations, veteran homes. We partnered with students. We explored the war from all sides and really gave a voice to what the war was about in a very personal way. And we could not have done this without the 100-plus community partners that we collaborated with. We had 40 story-sharing events and over 100 events that drew 25,000 people across the state, including two of my favorite events. One was with Tim O'Brien, the author of The Things They Carried, who was here talking about storytelling with the co-director of the Vietnam War series, Lynn Novick. And another, wrap it up here? Okay.
It's great. I'm sorry. My apologies. Because of running late with the...
No. That's okay. But I really appreciate this opportunity, and it's this funding that made it possible. And all of you have our report that we delivered to you, so I encourage you to check it out and read some more stories about how it made an impact.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. We'll have you back, too, when you do your request and kind of work through that as well. And Ms. Rowe and Mr. Sanford, and thank you very much for coming down. And Mr. Straczynski, thank you very much. If you ever have an opportunity to visit with him and hear his particular story about his service to this country, and it's amazing. So, Ed, if you want.
Mr. Chairman, finally, everybody's got a copy of this report. It's available online. You should know the programs you funded over the years have won over 60 Emmy Awards. For the kinds of quality stuff we did with the arts in the community. And the Vietnam Project won a Community Service Regional Emmy Award for the Upper Midwest for its participation for community service. So thank you so much. So you all know me. See me if you got questions. Yep.
Thank you for what you do, and I mean that sincerely, because I think, at the end of this 25 years, we're all, we're hoping we can renew this and go forth, and you're helping to tell that story, all the positive work and all the funds that are being done. So thank you. With that, we're adjourned.